Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here and to be involved in this. I think it's a great idea. And it's always exciting for me to be able to interact with you on the front lines of trying to overcome scientific illiteracy in this country. And so I think it's a particularly good idea. There are a lot of programs around the country that I'm involved in one way or another, involved with basic teaching of science. But the idea of introducing forefront topics and helping you all maintain your being up to date with science, I think is important. In fact, I hope we've just applied for a program at my university, Case Western Reserve, where we'll have a two-week program, I hope, on forefront science issues every year. So if we get funded, I may hope to see some of you there. And it's great to have a program on this topic, particularly after string theory. They wanted to have a topic having to do with the real universe, and so I agreed. In any case, what I'm going to do first is give an overview to the incredible conundrum we're in. We've discovered a lot in the last decade, and what we've come out of it with is more questions than answers. And I'd like to give an overview to that and present it as a mystery story, because it really is a mystery story, and the most exciting kind, because we don't know who did it yet. And so we're in the middle of a big puzzle, and I think that's an exciting way to view science, because again, when you present science to students, it's often presented as if it's all done. And this is certainly a topic that isn't. After my overview throughout the day, Martin White and Dan Acker will talk about the details of some of how you really understand some of these ideas, so you can save the difficult questions for them. As I say, this is a cosmic mystery story. And what I hope to do by the end of the talk, this is the night sky as you don't see it in Cleveland, but I'm told it has. I've been out here a few nights, I've seen stars. And it's nice to see what they really look like. But the interesting thing about what I hope to convince you of is that this is really not the whole picture. In fact, it's hardly any of the picture at all. Our understanding of the universe has changed so dramatically in the last decade that it's hard to really appreciate it. But what we've understood is that this is really the tip of a cosmic iceberg, a vast cosmic iceberg of dark matter and dark energy. And really, the most important stuff is the stuff you can't see. You could get rid of all the stars, all the planets, all the aliens, everything, and the universe would be largely the same. We're just a little bit of pollution added onto the real universe, which is something we've only begun to understand in the last few years. Okay, so let's go some history. So mystery story. It was 1916, a dark and stormy night, and Einstein had just developed his general theory of relativity, which was the first theory that really was a theory not just of how things move in space and time, but a theory of space and time itself. And such a theory, therefore, gave the opportunity not just to describe how objects move within the universe, but how the universe itself evolves. And however, there was a problem. Okay. Now, I want to present Einstein's equations here. And I don't know if there are any biology teachers here, but I want to present it first. No, I'm just joking. But actually, this isn't completely facetious, because the important thing about Einstein's equations is that on the left-hand side, one writes all sorts of quantities that relate to the geometry of the universe. And the great thing about Einstein's equations is they relate to us. They tell us that to produce a certain geometry, the source of that is the energy and momentum of all objects and all things within the universe. So this is wonderful, because it means in principle you can create a designer universe. If you tell me what geometry you want, mathematically, then I can write down at least the form of an energy and momentum that will produce that geometry, and whether you can actually get it physically is not known, and that's the source of lots of interesting things, including some things for Star Trek. But I had to write it down with the real Greek letters and everything. But essentially, this is the idea. Now, Einstein's equations, of course, as he discovered, suffered from the same problem that Newton's equations did. It's a huge problem, a problem that many of your students know well, and that is that gravity sucks. Okay? It always pulls, it never pushes. And Einstein had this beautiful picture of a universe, but the problem was that this equation could not describe that universe. Because in 1916, the universe was static, as far as Einstein knew. And the problem with general relativity, as with Newtonian gravity, is that you can't have a static system with lots of masses lying around, because gravity is universally attractive. You put stars and galaxies down, and you lay them down there, and they'll eventually collapse together, because gravity is universally attractive. And he had this problem that he looked and saw a static universe, yet he had this theory that could not allow for a static universe. Now he was, if nothing else, creative. And he realized that there was an extra term he could add to his equations, innocuous looking. And this extra term he called the cosmological term. He realized this could be introduced without changing any of the symmetries that had led him to, the mathematical symmetries that had led him to discover this beautiful equation. But the effect of this extra term would be to produce a small repulsive force throughout nature, everywhere. It could be so small that you'd never notice it on human scales, which is fine because we don't notice it. But on scales of galaxies, on the large scale universe, it could build up. And it principally felt it could hold galaxies apart, balancing the standard gravitational attraction, and produce a static universe. So that's why he introduced this term, the cosmological term. Now, the problem is that the minute he introduced it, it had problems. And when I was on sabbatical in Switzerland a few years ago, I got a hold of a postcard from Einstein to Weyl, a very famous mathematical physicist, 1923. And my German isn't that good, but it basically it says, if you get rid of a quasi-static universe, then out with the cosmological constant. He realized, because by 1923, people had begun to realize the universe wasn't static. By 1929, as I'll show you, Hubble had demonstrated convincingly that the universe wasn't static. And Einstein realized that if you didn't have a static universe, if the universe was in fact expanding, you didn't need a cosmological constant. Because if you start a universe expanding, then gravity can be universally attractive and pull everything back together again. And the key question is there enough gravitational force to stop that expansion and have the universe recollapse, or not, and have the universe expand forever? And that became the business of cosmology for much of the rest of the 20th century, is trying to determine what the future of the universe would be, and we'll get there. Now, as I say, the fact that the universe was expanding was convincingly demonstrated by this man, who gives me great hope for humanity, because Hubble, proof, it's proof that people can eventually do useful things. Hubble started life as a lawyer, and eventually recognized that he could do something useful, as I say, and he discovered a number of tremendous things. In fact, one of the first things that Hubble discovered in 1923, and this I want to mention this because it gives you a perspective for how things are changing. That in 1923, our universe was our galaxy. Our island galaxy was the only thing that people knew of in our universe. There were things, there were smudgy things called nebulae, which is Greek for smudgy thing, that people saw at telescopes. But when the Mount Wilson telescope was built in 1923, Hubble looked through it and was able to realize that those smudgy things were in fact other island universes, other galaxies. We now know that there are over 100 billion galaxies in the observable universe. We live in one of them. Okay? But we didn't know of any of the others till 1923. So we're really in a situation where we're like the early map makers. We're just beginning to understand the universe on large scales, and therefore it's not surprising that there are exciting new discoveries being made all the time, which was one of the reasons why this is such a neat time to be alive. Now, what Hubble discovered is, in fact, as many of you have probably seen, that when you look out at distant galaxies, they are, on average, moving away from us. And in fact, those that are twice as far away from us are moving twice as fast away from us. Now, the first thing that comes to mind when you see that is that, of course, the natural conclusion is that we're the center of the universe. And while those who live in Santa Barbara may feel that, in fact, that's not what this implies at all. Before I get back, we codify this as saying velocity is proportional to distance, and this constant of proportionality is called the Hubble constant. And it's a very important quantity that we'll come back to. But I want to just try and demonstrate for you, and this is a demonstration I think you can do for your students, to try and explain why what this really means is that the universe is expanding. The point is, we have the problem that we're living on a specific galaxy, and so what we see makes us look like we're the center of the universe. But the point is, any galaxy you sit on in an expanding universe looks like it's the center of the universe. And so to try and demonstrate this, I take a bunch of dots here, and now I've taken the same system and I've expanded the distance between the dots. So this whole system is uniformly expanding. And if you stand outside the box, it's obvious it's uniformly expanding. The problem is we live inside the box. So let's pick one galaxy, say that one, okay? And see what the picture looks like if I superimpose this image on that one, always staying at the same point. So let me move this over there so the two overlap. Oops. And you will see that what you see if you're standing in that galaxy is that all other galaxies are moving away from you. And in fact, those that are twice as far away have moved twice as far away from you during that time. So if you're standing here, everything looks like it's moving away from you. And the point is, it's true for any place. I can pick a galaxy anywhere. Let me just superimpose them there. And you'll see exactly the same thing there. And just for fun, put it on the edge. And you see everything is moving away from there. So as long as there are no edges, if you're in a uniformly expanding box, wherever you stand, you always look like you're the center. And so when you saw that picture before where everything was moving away from us, we're not the center. What it really indicates is that the universe is expanding. Now, how do we know that? So this is the conclusion. We know that there's a transparency that I was going to bring, but I didn't want to use an overhead. I love it. If these two cowboys sitting in the desert with a train, they're in horses, and there's a train going by, and one of the guys says to the other, "I love listening to that lonesome wail of the train as the frequency of the sound changes due to the Doppler effect." And in fact, as many of you teach the Doppler effect, that's exactly what we use to discover the universe is expanding. In principle, it's quite simple. When we look at light from a star, one of the most important things about that light is that it comes in a certain series of colors, a spectrum. And that is profoundly important, actually, and I think too few people appreciate how important that is. Because when I actually put on my other hat, one of them, the Star Trek hat, I meet a lot of people who have either been abducted by aliens or know people who have been abducted by aliens. And in fact, I've been in various places where otherwise reasonable people say to me, "Well, you know, maybe aliens are coming here." I say, "No, because of all the problems." And they say, "Well, maybe the laws of physics are just simply different on those planets." And one of the things we really know, and I think it's really worth pointing out to students, is that we have measured that the laws of physics are really the same throughout the observable universe in profoundly important ways. For example, one of the great discoveries of the 20th century involved quantum mechanics. And quantum mechanics helped us understand the frequency, the spectrum of light emitted by hydrogen. When we look at stars, we see a certain set of colors, and those colors are exactly the same as we see when we heat up hydrogen in the laboratory. The same spectrum, it's a fingerprint. That tells us, first, that stars are made of hydrogen. But more importantly, perhaps, it tells us that the same laws of physics are operating on those stars, because one of the great triumphs of quantum mechanics was to understand the spectrum of hydrogen. And it involved knowing everything we know about electromagnetism, as I say, quantum mechanics. And so the fact that we understand that spectrum and we can predict it, and the fact that the spectrum is identical in stars here, in our galaxy and another galaxy, tells us that the laws of quantum mechanics and electromagnetism, two of the fundamental pillars of 20th century physics, in fact, operate exactly the same throughout the universe. So it's one of the handles. We can actually measure that the laws of physics are the same. That's an aside, but I think it's important and maybe useful for you to talk to your students about. But in any case, when we look at stars that are moving away from us, the Doppler effect kicks in, and we see that the frequency, the wavelength of light of objects moving away from us is stretched out, just like sound is stretched out as a train is moving away from you, and the wavelength stretched out, so the sound is lower. When the train's moving towards you, the waves get scrunched up, and the wavelength gets smaller, the frequency higher. And with light, longer frequencies are the red end of the spectrum and shorter frequencies are the blue end of the spectrum. So objects moving away from us are red-shifted, objects moving towards us are blue-shifted, and if with a galaxy it's rotating, you can look at those different things. And so what Hubble was able to do was measure this redshift effect as a function of distance, and this is his data from 1929. This, by the way, shows why he was such a great scientist. Because he knew to draw a straight line through that data set. And when he did, he discovered there was a relationship between velocity and distance, and that was the number he got, which is only a factor of 10 wrong. Which in cosmology is pretty good, or was pretty good until the last decade. In fact, this caused a huge problem, by the way, because the fact that the universe was expanding at this rate, you could work out, gave an age to the universe which was younger than the age of the Earth, and that was a huge problem at the time. And it seemed to be a problem for everyone because creationism hadn't yet kicked in this country again. Anyway, we now measure this more carefully, and we do it by trying to see. The easy part is measuring the velocity of objects. The hard part is measuring their distance. Because you want to relate velocity to distance, you have to measure both. And as I say, velocity is easy because it's the Doppler effect. But distance, how do you measure the distance to a distant galaxy? Well, you don't have tape measures that can do it. But if I can measure the distance to the back of the room if I had an old-fashioned light meter that was on cameras back when I was younger. Okay, if I turned on all the lights and I took a 100-watt light bulb in the back of the room and I measured the intensity of light on my light meter, I'd be able to use the fact that the light spreads out uniformly in all directions and calculate, and know if I knew it was 100 watts and I calculated the power that I saw here, I'd be able to determine the distance to the back of the room. Okay? And now, unfortunately, the universe isn't populated by 100-watt light bulbs. But we have to look for the equivalent, something we call a standard candle, something whose intrinsic luminosity we believe we understand, and therefore we see how bright it is when we see it from here, and then we determine its distance that way. And that's been one of the revolutions in the last decade that's been possible because of the Hubble Space Telescope, which you'll learn about later today. At least you'll learn about one of the repair missions from one of the astronauts who repaired it. What we look for, and here's a Hubble picture, are we're trying to find standard candles in distant galaxies. And the reason the Hubble Space Telescope is called the Hubble Space Telescope is because it could look for standard candles in distant galaxies and therefore measure the Hubble constant. So it wasn't just named after Hubble because Hubble was a great guy, but it actually, one of the prime purposes of that telescope was to measure the Hubble constant. And it could do that by looking, what the Hubble telescope could do for the first time was resolve individual stars in galaxies. And these particular stars, called Cepheid variable stars, they're stars that vary in brightness over a period of days. And you could look at these stars nearby and determine an amazing relationship, that as the stars got brighter and dimmer, the period over which the star would vary in its brightness was directly proportional to the brightness of the star. And that could be confirmed for lots of stars nearby. And then if you could see these individual stars in distant galaxies, measure their period of brightness, you'd be able to determine exactly how intrinsically bright they were. Then you'd look and see how bright they seemed, and you'd measure the distance to galaxies out to almost 50 million light years away from us. Amazing fact. And so that's for nearby galaxies, but if you want to measure the rate of the expanding universe further away, these individual stars are not bright enough to see on the other end of the universe. So you use other objects, and this is one of my favorite pictures, because it looks like a painting, but it's not. It's a Hubble Space Telescope picture. It's a distant galaxy, and this bright object here is an exploding star, a supernova. And supernovae, when stars explode, they produce a brightness of about 10 billion stars. And you can see them. They're sometimes brighter than a whole galaxy, as I'll show you. And you can see them at other ends of the visible universe. And I want to just talk about these for a second, because they're going to come back and become important later on. Here's, you can see, here's a distant galaxy, and you can see that at a certain time, this is before the discovery of a supernova, when the supernova goes off, this supernova basically is as bright as the whole galaxy. And if you subtract the brightness of these two pictures, you can see this object. And what was discovered, again, phenomenologically, and that word just simply means we don't understand why, but we understand how, is an amazing fact. When you look at these certain types of supernovae, called type 1a supernovae, that can be distinguished from their spectrum, from the colors of light they emit, if we're lucky enough to see them before they blow up and then afterwards, they get bright and they get dim on a period of order a month or so. And what was discovered for nearby supernovae, whose distance you could confirm by other techniques, by Cepheid variable techniques, for example, is that the brighter supernovae would last longer, and the less bright supernovae would last less long. And in fact, if you take all of these curves and just scale them by the length of time between, say, some initial brightness and some final brightness, all of these curves reduce to exactly the same curve, to high accuracy. And this tells us that these objects are, in principle, great standard candles. They can, in principle, allow us to determine the distance to galaxies at the other end of the visible universe. Because all you have to do is measure a supernova, see how long it's bright, and then you know its brightness. Then you see how bright it seems, and you use the fact that light, that intensity of light goes as 1 over r squared, the distance between us and the supernova, and you can determine its distance. And so using, for example, type 1a supernovae, here is the new Hubble plot, and you can see it's a log-log plot, so everything looks linear, but it is much better than the old Hubble plot, and one gets now a number for the Hubble constant. It doesn't really matter what the number is. It's about 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec. A megaparsec is a few million light years, which is the average distance between galaxies. And it says the average galaxy a few million light years away from us is moving away from us about 70 kilometers per second. One that's 2 megaparsecs away is moving 140 kilometers per second, and so on. Okay, it's a number. We know it to about 10% accuracy after the few billion dollars the Hubble Space Telescope and other programs. And that's an amazing development in cosmology. It's a very difficult quantity to measure, but you'll see it's probably one of the most important quantities you can hope to measure about the universe. Now, I want to come back. So, there's a long segue to talk about why this isn't needed. And when Einstein realized it wasn't needed because the universe was expanding, he called it his greatest blunder that he'd introduced it. But the trouble is, sort of, you know, so he tried to throw it out. And like it's like getting toothpaste back in the tube after you've gotten out. You can't get it back in very easily. And in fact, if Einstein hadn't invented the cosmological term, someone else would have. Okay. Now, by a complicated algebraic transformation, one can write this way. Now, yeah, this is a small step for a mathematician, but a giant leap for a physicist. For the reasons I said, when I put the cosmological term on this side of the equation, it looks like a geometric quantity. But when I put it on this side of the equation, it suddenly looks like an extra contribution to the energy of the universe. And one can ask, what type of stuff would produce that contribution? And the answer is, nothing. Not nothing, but nothing. Namely, if you give energy to empty space, you can show that it will produce a term like this in Einstein's equations. And only empty space, essentially. So if I give empty space energy, I can produce a cosmological constant. Now you may say, who the hell cares? Because anyone knows the energy of empty space is zero. You ask any of your students, they don't even know what energy is. But if you ask what the energy of nothing is, they'll probably say zero. Okay? That's a sensible answer. And that was a sensible answer for many years. The problem is, it's not so sensible because of the laws of quantum mechanics and relativity. Those two became unified to the Second World War. And we recognize when those are unified, they predict something remarkable. They predict the fact that empty space is not empty. Empty space is a boiling, bubbling brew of virtual particles that pop out of nothingness and disappear again in a time so short you can't see them. Okay? Sounds like counting angels on the head of a pin. But in fact, while we can't see virtual particles directly, we can see them indirectly, and we know they exist. And in fact, one of the ways we know they exist is by thinking again of the spectrum of hydrogen. You know, we now understand a hydrogen atom has, you know, got an electron and a proton, and we understand the energy levels of hydrogen because of the laws of quantum mechanics, and we can predict the frequencies of light that are emitted when electrons jump between those energy levels, the frequencies of light that are either absorbed or emitted. Okay? The problem is, when we calculate this, we get it wrong. We get the answer wrong if we just use quantum mechanics. When we add relativity in, it predicts that there are these virtual particles in there. And therefore, hydrogen atoms don't really look like that. They kind of look like this. There's the electron and positron, but every now and then, an electron and its antiparticle, a positron, spontaneously appear, hang around for a while, and then disappear. And the electron wants to hang around the nucleus, and the positron gets repelled and is out there. And that means the the hydrogen atom is a little more complicated. It hasn't got just a proton and electron in it. It's got a proton, electron, and all these virtual particles. And therefore, the electric field that this electron is orbiting in is slightly different than it would be otherwise. And we can actually calculate the difference. And we can calculate the change in the spectrum of hydrogen. And it is one of the great, often unsung triumphs of particle physics in the latter half of the 20th century, that in fact, this is the best prediction in all of physics. If you compare the measured frequencies of transition in a hydrogen atom compared to the predicted frequencies and divide them by the prediction, they agree to better than 1 part in 10 to the 9th. This is the best measured number in the world compared to any prediction. It's a great triumph of the theory called quantum electrodynamics that explains this. And so we know virtual particles exist. And if you're not getting this from that, you can actually look at their effect in another place. As the Dutch physicist Casimir once recognized, that if you put two parallel plates together, it turns out the virtual particles that can appear between the plates are different than the virtual particles that can appear outside the plates. And that the fact that more virtual particles can appear outside the plates means that there's a net pressure that tends to push the plates together. And you can actually do the experiment. Here's a Casimir experiment. And when you do that, you find out the pressure you get is exactly that predicted by quantum electrodynamics again. So we know that these crazy virtual particles exist. Okay, now if empty space isn't empty, therefore, if it's full of this stuff, not only can it contribute effects such as this, maybe it can contribute to the energy of the universe. If empty space isn't empty, it might as well have energy. These virtual particles might carry energy. Now you can try and estimate how much energy the vacuum should have, empty space should have. And when you do it, you come up with a prediction that the energy of empty space should be roughly a gazillion times the energy of everything we see. Now this is the worst prediction in all of physics. And for that reason, we never used to talk about it. Okay? Because we weren't too happy about it. But in fact, the resolution of this was, for many physicists, for many years, since I've been a graduate student, has been to say, well, a miracle occurs. And maybe, since the only sensible value for the energy of empty space is really zero, somehow the contribution of all the energy of all these virtual particles cancels out exactly, and the energy of empty space is zero, and we can go to sleep at night. So that's what the assumption was. The good thing about physics is, however, that it's an empirical science, and as pretty as that idea is, we should test it. But nevertheless, the thing I want to point out is that the only sensible value for this quantity, because you can't imagine, physicists try and say, well, let me try and get rid of that number. Let me cancel it out. Okay? But if I want to cancel it out, not exactly, in fact, let's say I want to make sure that the vacuum energy is not bigger than the energy of everything we see, then I have to cancel this number out to 120 decimal places and leave something finite left over. Now, there's no way we know, theoretically, to cancel numbers to 120 decimal places and leave something finite left over. There's no example in physics where it works like that. There are examples, however, where quantities are made to be exactly zero. We introduce new symmetries of nature that forbid those quantities to exist, and then we understand why they're zero, why the net charge of the universe is zero, for example, things like that. So we can understand zero. We can't understand a very small number. Okay? So the only sensible value is zero. Now there's another reason why we know the energy of empty space has to be zero, or we thought we knew that. That is, we can look at the energy density of all matter in the universe as the universe expands. So the universe is expanding, and the density of matter is going down as 1 over the volume. So I've drawn it logarithmically here. This is the density of matter in grams per cubic centimeter as the universe expands. This is when the first galaxies formed, this is when the solar system formed, everywhere except for Kansas and Ohio, and this is now, and this is when our sun is going to die 5 billion years from now. And you see that density changes. Now, how does the energy density of empty space change as the universe expands? The answer is it doesn't change at all. The argument is quite simple. There's nothing there to dilute, so how could it change? Okay? If you don't like that, I'm sorry, but it turns out the equations of general relativity tell you that the energy density of empty space is a constant. And so, if it has some number which is, say, comparable to the energy of everything we see today, this is the only time in the history of the universe when the two are comparable. At all earlier times, the energy of empty space would be irrelevant, and at all later times, it would dominate. So why, 10 billion years into the expansion of the universe or so, 10 to 15 billion years, should the two be comparable? It's ridiculous. So for those reasons, the only sensible value for this quantity is zero. Okay? But as I say, we want to actually determine whether that's the answer experimentally or observationally. And the first person to propose a way to do that was, in fact, George Orwell, who said, to see what is in front of one's nose requires a constant struggle. And this is what he meant by this. In an expanding universe with this cosmological constant, everything has a repulsive force pushing it away. And that means, in fact, that objects will be moving away from us, and those objects that are twice as far away will be moving twice as fast, and that constant, that velocity constant, that Hubble constant, if you wish, will be the same for all eternity. And that tells us that, okay, if an object's moving twice as fast if it's twice as far away, then it's moving four times as fast if it's four times as far away. When it gets to a certain distance away from me, it'll be moving faster than the speed of light. That's possible in general relativity. Okay, we all teach our students often that nothing can move faster than the speed of light, but that's wrong. You have to be a little bit more like a lawyer and parse that a little more carefully. Objects cannot move through space, nearby space, faster than the speed of light, but space can do whatever the heck it wants, okay, in general relativity, and therefore objects being carried by an expanding space can move away faster than the speed of light. It's happening right now. Okay. As we sit here, there are objects. In fact, not only can they be moving faster than the speed of light, but they can also be standing still at the same time. Okay, we're not moving very fast with respect to each other, depending on how much coffee you had before you came. But so we're here not moving. An audience of teachers in a galaxy at the other end of the visible universe is not moving very fast with respect to their surroundings. But they're moving away from us at the speed of light, and we're moving away from them at the speed of light. How is that possible? Well, they're at rest and we're at rest, but the space between us is expanding. Okay? Now, you can do an experiment. Okay? Say you're Bill Clinton and your nose is sort of 10 centimeters long or something, okay? You can ask, how small would the energy of empty space have to be so that you can see the end of your nose? Because if the energy of empty space was bigger than a certain number, the space at the end of your nose would be moving away from you faster than the speed of light and you couldn't see the end of your nose. Light would never catch up. And if just from the fact that you can see the end of your nose, you work out that the bound on the energy of empty space is actually 60 orders of magnitude smaller than that prediction, that the energy of empty space was a gazillion, 120 orders of magnitude larger than the energy of everything we see. So we already know, just from the fact that we can see the end of our nose, we could do that experiment, that the energy of empty space is 60 orders of magnitude smaller than that naive prediction, which is one of the many reasons we know it's wrong. But of course, we don't just see the end of our nose, we can see the end of the room. But better than that, if we open the doors and look outside, we can see at night the end of the universe. We can see objects that are billions of light years away. And from the fact that we can see objects that are billions of light years away, we know that the energy of empty space cannot be bigger substantially than the energy of everything we see. Okay? But it also tells us that we're stuck with astrophysics. There are particle physicists, and my origins are in particle theory, who say, oh, well, you know, who believes astrophysics, okay? Because it's observations, it's not experiments. In a laboratory, you can kick the apparatus, and you can't do that for the universe. And that means that there's a huge difference between observing things and measuring them in the laboratory. But we're stuck, because you have to see to the other ends of the universe to begin to probe this energy density, if it were there. There's no way we know of in a laboratory that we can detect it. So if we want to measure the energy of empty space, we have to measure it in the universe and not in the laboratory. Okay, so how are we going to do that? Well, we add up the energy of the universe. We weigh it. How do we weigh the universe? We stand on the shoulders of giants. Okay? Does anyone know who this is?
Lenin.
What? No, not Lenin. who? You know? Brahe, that's right. If you look very carefully, you see he doesn't have the end of his nose. And this is Tycho Brahe. This is on the island of Ven, which used to be a Danish island, is now a Swedish island, before the invention of the telescope, worked on his back for 20 years, a noble tradition, and basically looked, and as you know, basically measured the position of the planets in the sky every night. That's what he did for his productive period of his career. And then he had as you know, an assistant when he got kicked out of that island for being a rotten feudal landlord, among other things. He moved and he got an assistant, Johannes Kepler, who was different about every way you can imagine. Anyway, enough of history. Kepler spent 20 years analyzing that data without a Macintosh or anything, and fudged it a little bit, apparently, according to historians, and discovered Kepler's laws, which we can write in the following way. Kepler's laws, one of which gives a relationship between the velocity of planets around the sun and their distance from the sun. And, in fact, here it is here, and I've already jumped ahead. I didn't plan to do that here, but I was just adjusting these slides this morning because they weren't working. What you get is this remarkable, remarkable relationship between the velocity of planets and the distance from the sun. In particular, the fact, as you all know when you teach your students, that there's a relationship that the velocity of planets, the square of the velocity of planets around the sun, is proportional to 1 over the distance from the sun. That's Kepler's law, stated another way, okay, a way that's more useful. Now, what made Newton famous, one of the first things that made him famous, is that he said, okay, if there's a force between the sun and the planets that varies as 1 over r squared, I will predict that the velocity of planets squared goes as 1 over r. And the constant of proportionality depends upon the strength of gravity and the mass of the sun. Okay? This means, in principle, if you know the strength of gravity, you can weigh the sun by measuring the velocity of planets around the sun. And in fact, by the way, that's the reason that the paper 100 years later, where Newton didn't know the strength of gravity, couldn't measure it. But 100 years later, it was measured. And that paper, when you read it, when you look at it, the title of that paper is not called On Measuring the Strength of Gravity. Okay. It's called Weighing the Earth. Even then, they knew that if you want to get a paper recognized by your colleagues, you have to give it a sexy title. And so, in fact, this was the first way we could weigh the Earth, because only when we knew the strength of gravity could we determine the mass of the Earth, and the same happens for the sun. If Newton's prediction is that, in fact, the velocity of objects orbiting the sun should vary as the mass of the sun over a radius of 1/2. And so what one does to weigh the mass of the sun is just take a curve whose form is as 1 over the square root of r and overlap it upon the data, and you see it agrees remarkably well, better than it should in principle. It's a remarkable agreement. I would have fudged the data if I needed to, but I didn't. I just took the data straight out of an astronomy textbook. And from that, you can in fact determine that the mass of the sun accurately from having 9 planets, or 8 if you're in New York and you don't believe Pluto's a planet. For measuring that, you can determine the mass of the sun in principle to 1 part in a billion. The agreement is actually that good. We can't. Does anyone know why we can't? We learn when we're teaching to ask questions to students to wake them up. I guess that's what I was trying. Well, the sun's losing mass, yeah, but at any instant, in principle, we could measure it. It's actually, the fact is, remember, we need to know this quantity here, the strength of gravity. And gravity is the worst measured force in nature. In spite of the fact that it's what the first to have been discovered, it's so weak that it's difficult to measure, and we only know it now to 1 part in 100,000, the strength of the gravitational coupling. And that was already a factor of 10 improvement from a decade ago. And so, because of this, we can only know the mass of the sun to 1 part in 100,000. Because we're limited in our understanding of gravity. Okay? Anyway, okay, so like Hollywood, if it works, copy it. So if it worked for the Earth, why not measure the mass of the galaxy? So we can try and measure the mass of the galaxy, and we can measure the mass of the galaxy because we are in a spiral galaxy. This isn't our galaxy. Why? Okay, I just want to see if you're right. Okay, we live in our galaxy, okay. But if this were our galaxy, we'd be sort of living in a boring suburb. I don't mean Santa Barbara, but I mean where the Earth and the Sun are at the edge of the galaxy, orbiting the galaxy. And because we're orbiting the galaxy, we can use Newton's laws to weigh the galaxy. And in fact, by the way, just to prove this, that we do live in a spiral galaxy, this is a beautiful picture taken from the Cosmic Background Explorer satellite in 1989. We can't see most of our galaxy because most of our galaxy is obscured by dust, okay? Invisible light. But if you go to radio and microwave, we can see our galaxy. And this is actually a picture of our galaxy taken with the Cosmic Background Explorer satellite, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, which measures microwave and radio radiation. And you can see that we indeed live at the edge of a spiral galaxy. It's a beautiful picture that we wouldn't have been able to have until about a decade ago. Okay, so we now know the Sun is at a certain distance from the galaxy, and in fact we can measure its orbital velocity around the galaxy. It's a little over 200 kilometers per second. And just from that one data point, we can use Newton's laws to say how much mass is inside of our orbit. And since we're on the outside of our galaxy, we can weigh the whole galaxy. And when we do that, we come up with a remarkable number. We actually come up with a mass of our galaxy of about 10 to the 11th solar masses. Okay, 100 billion times the mass of the Sun. When we get that, we jump up and down. We jump up and down because if you count the number of stars in our galaxy, it's roughly 100 billion. So you get the 100 billion stars, 100 billion times the mass of the Sun. Everything works. But you can try and do better. Say, well, let's do it like for the planets around the Sun. Instead of just one data point, our Sun, let's look for objects that are further and further away from the center of our galaxy, from where we are, and try and measure this curve better. Because if we're at the edge of our galaxy, there's no stuff out further out, we can predict from Newton's law that this curve should fall off as 1 over the square root of r, just like for the planets around our Sun. Well, when we do that, we come up with a problem. Even the untutored physicists would recognize that this is not a good agreement. In fact, as good as the agreement was for the planets around the Sun, this is that bad. When we look at objects, globular clusters, small compact groups of stars at the edge of our galaxy, the Large Magellanic Clouds, and even other small satellites around our galaxy, what appears to be the case is that this velocity remains constant. And it turns out, and it's an exercise for you, we can talk about it in the break, that you can show, if you plug this into Newton's laws, what this tells you is that the only way to get what's called a flat rotation curve like this, is if the mass inside any region continues to increase proportionally to the distance away from the center. So the mass in the galaxy continues to increase, and since we're going out to 10 times as far from the galactic center as we are, there appears to be at least 10 times as much mass out there as in here. Now that's a problem because when you look at our galaxy, we're at the edge. And this was the first evidence for what's become known as dark matter, which you're going to hear about. Now, when you first see data like this, the first thing you should do is not believe it. Okay? I mean, whenever you read data, especially in the New York Times, the first thing you should do is not believe it. Okay? But in fact, if you measure other galaxies, here's a rotation curve for another galaxy. It's easier to measure the rotation curve of other galaxies because we live outside them and we can actually see all the stars and look at the Doppler shift of the stars moving towards us and away from us. And when we look at every galaxy we can see, and there's a whole bunch of them I think I have here, you measure flat rotation curves in all of them. It seems to be ubiquitous. And so this tells us that, as far as we can tell, at least 10 times as much stuff exists in the universe as meets the eye. The universe, the mass of the universe, is dominated by dark matter. Moreover, there are arguments, which I won't go into here, I don't know whether Dan will, that tell us that it's virtually impossible to understand this dark matter unless it's made of something other than the same stuff we are. Some new type of elementary particle that doesn't interact strongly. And in fact, if that's the case, it's very exciting, because that dark matter is not just up there, it's in this room, going through you as you nod off throughout this lecture, okay? And in fact, if it's going through this room, you can build experiments to look for it. And that's what Dan is going to talk about, because we talk about dark matter, but he actually searches for it. By the way, here's one of the kinds of materials used to search for dark matter. This is the most important stuff in the world. Does anyone know what this is? Silicon, very good, okay. It's the most important substance because it's what computer chips are made of. And stuff like this, silicon and germanium, can be used to look for dark matter, and I won't tell you how because Dan will, okay? But we are looking, and in fact, the neat thing about this is that science is not philosophy. We predict the dark matter is out there. As far as we can tell, it's out there. We have every reason to believe it's a new elementary particle, but that's not good enough. We have to detect it to really believe it's there. And the amazing thing is, the truly amazing thing is, that we can build experiments to detect this stuff. So if it's there, you'll read in the New York Times or in the next decade about Dan and his colleagues and other people around the world who are searching to look for this dark matter. Okay. Now, you might say, especially if you're like my wife, who cares? Okay. Now, you might not care about dark matter, but one of the reasons you come to things like this is that is that it turns out the amount of dark matter determines what the future of the universe will be, we thought. Because, you know, we like to say that, in fact, we live... The fact that Einstein told us that energy curves space and time and tells us that we live in one of three possible geometries, an open, closed, or flat universe. And in a universe dominated with matter, well, there are pretty pictures of the geometry. This is a two-dimensional picture of a three-dimensional geometry, so the real universe is not curved in two dimensions, but potentially in three dimensions. In a closed universe, it curves back upon itself, so if you look very far in that direction, you'll see the back of your head. Okay? But operationally, much more importantly, we used to say, well, if we live in an open universe, it will go on expanding forever. A closed universe will expand out to a certain point and then recollapse in a big crunch, the opposite of a big bang. And a flat universe, which is the border between these two, will just go on expanding forever, slowing down but never quite stopping. And it turns out that to determine which universe we live in, the universe dominated with matter, we have to know how much matter there is from Einstein's equations. Because Einstein's equations tell us that the energy and momentum determine the curvature. So we have to know how much matter there is, and if the universe is dominated with dark matter, we want to know how much dark matter there is so we can determine the future of the universe. And actually, that is the reason that 20-some-odd years ago I got interested in cosmology from particle physics. Because I was amazed by the thought that I might live in the first generation in the history of humanity that would be able to determine the future of the universe, know how the universe will end. That was such a profound and amazing thought to me that it seemed to me I should worry about dark matter, which I did. And so that's why we want to determine how much dark matter there is. And so we want to ask, well, you know, does that flat rotation curve continue out forever? How much total mass is in there in the universe if you want to go out beyond galaxies? Well, to determine how the universe will end, in fact, it's really quite simple. It's the same as determining when I take a coin and throw it up in the air, whether it'll come back down. Okay? If I throw it up at some velocity, it comes back down. If I throw it up with a bigger velocity, it comes back down and I miss it. And then if I throw it up really fast, which I'm not going to do, it won't come down at all. I throw it with a velocity greater than the escape velocity of the Earth. And again, from a high school physics perspective, you can teach your students how to calculate that escape velocity, and many of you do. You just determine it by the total energy of that coin. That energy has two pieces. The kinetic energy of motion, so if I throw things up, that's positive. And the gravitational potential energy that's pulling it back down, that's negative. So there's a positive piece and a negative piece. And the high school calculation is very simple. If the total energy is greater than zero, the coin will escape. If the total energy is less than zero, the coin will return back to Earth. And we can do the same for our universe. Here's a region of our universe, and here's a galaxy moving away from us. Here, if we're at the center. And Hubble tells us that the velocity of that galaxy away from us is proportional to the Hubble constant. And if the universe is the same everywhere, then to determine whether it expands forever comes down to just determining whether this simple galaxy will keep moving away from us. Because if it keeps moving away from us, everything will. If it's going to collapse and come back to us, everything will collapse. As long as the universe is isotropic on large scales, that holds true. And so therefore, determining what the future of the universe comes down to simply determining the total energy of this galaxy. And the energy has two pieces. One, the Hubble constant. That's why we need to know it. Because the kinetic energy is related to the speed it's moving, and the speed it's moving comes from the Hubble constant. So after 7 years, we can measure that to maybe 10%. But that's the easy part. Because to determine the potential energy of gravity that's pulling it back in, we have to know the mass density in this region. And the mass density is the hard part, because with telescopes, you just see light. And the universe seems to be dominated by dark matter. So that's why we need to know how much dark matter there is, because in fact, the amount of dark matter will determine the density of matter in here and determine the gravitational potential energy of this object. But in principle, it's a homework assignment. You can measure this quantity in your backyard, you want to measure this quantity in your backyard, and then you just take B over A. And if B over A is bigger than 1, if this quantity is bigger than this quantity, then the negative piece dominates over the positive piece, the universe will collapse. If B over A is less than 1, the universe will expand forever. Now, physicists, whenever they get a quantity that's very important, give it a Greek letter. So we give it a Greek letter, we call it omega. Measuring omega was the business of cosmology in the 20th century. The whole 20th century was basically after Hubble discovered the expansion of the universe, more or less, was devoted to trying to determine this quantity. Now, you see the problems, of course, because this is hard to measure, but this is even harder to measure. But in the last decade, thanks to a lot of tools, we've been able to measure this a lot better. And one of the ways, one of the great tools, has been the Hubble Space Telescope. This was one of the earliest pictures of the Hubble Deep Field, which is one of the beautiful pictures that I find inspiring, because every dot in here is not a star, but a galaxy. And among the hundreds of billions of galaxies in the universe, located billions of light years away. So that means most of the stars in these galaxies no longer are shining anymore. Okay, this is it. We do cosmic archaeology when we look out at the universe. But the thing you see about this is that galaxies like to be clumped together in clusters. And in fact, we can now use, in principle, Newton's laws for understanding the motion of galaxies in clusters to try and figure out how much dark matter there is in these clusters. But there are two techniques that have been used in the last decade that are just, again, recently possible because of new windows on the universe. That's one of the morals I want to leave you with. Every time we open a new window on the universe, we make a new discovery. And with you looking at, it turns out that, again, in this picture, you think the galaxies are important, but they're not. The dominant stuff, normal stuff, protons and neutrons, the dominant stuff here is not in the galaxies, but in the gas surrounding the galaxies, which is very hot. That hot gas emits X-rays. And with X-ray telescopes, which you need to use in space because the X-rays don't get down to the atmosphere, we can look at these clusters of galaxies and measure the X-ray temperature of the hot gas. And that, in turn, can be used to understand how much mass there is, because the gas is moving in a gravitational potential well, and how hot it is related to that potential well. And you can actually try and weigh the galaxy by measuring the X-rays in a way that's actually quite doable, and I'm happy to talk about to any of you afterwards. But there's an easier way, in principle, and it requires just a picture, and it's a beautiful picture. Here's a cluster of galaxies, and this is a phenomena that Einstein first predicted in 1937, I think, and he actually said it would never be observable. His theory of general relativity told us that light bends when it goes around an object. Okay, and that was what was observed in 1919, and that's really what made Einstein famous, not special relativity, but the observation of light bending around the sun. Now, he said, okay, if that's the case, then I can imagine something I'll call a gravitational lens. If I have enough mass, I could take an object behind some mass and have the light bend all around it, and I could magnify it, or in fact, I could produce multiple images of that object by the mass distribution. And he said this can happen in principle, but we'll never see it. It's just a phenomenon that's too difficult to see, but of course he underestimated the ability of observers and experimenters. Here, with the Hubble Space Telescope picture, I think, yes it is a picture of a cluster of galaxies, and you see, even again the untutored observer can see that there's these blue things here that stand out, and what they are many images of a single galaxy located 5 billion light years behind this cluster. And the light from that galaxy is bent by the mass, the curvature of space around that mass distribution. It's remarkable. But more remarkable still is the fact that we understand general relativity, and therefore from this picture, we can work backwards and say, what's the mass that's producing this image? You can invert that, and when you do that, here's the picture of the mass distribution. And the mass distribution, the peaks are where the galaxies are, but you notice that there's this uniform stuff in between them, and that's the dark matter. And from images like this, and from techniques like this and the X-ray data that I showed you earlier, we now know, and this is again less than 5 years old, we now appear to know unambiguously that the total amount of mass in these largest systems, clusters of galaxies, the largest objects we know of in the universe, is only 30% of the mass needed to make the universe flat or to close the universe. Unambiguously, plus or minus maybe 5 to 10%. We now know that there's not enough matter to make the universe flat. Unambiguously. And again, a decade ago, we didn't know that. Okay. The problem is, of course, that all of these methods are indirect, because maybe somehow we're missing some mass on larger scales or something. So what would really be nice is to measure the geometry of the universe directly. To go out and measure whether we live in a flat universe or not. In the last 3 years, we've been able to do that. This is all new. So how would you measure whether the universe is curved? Okay, well, it's a Homer problem again. How can you measure the curvature of the Earth if you had no recourse to outside space, to seeing the horizon drop off, and no ability to go around, completely around the Earth? Okay, well, I drew this to remind you. Many of you know the answer. As most European students could tell us, the sum of the angles in a triangle in a flat plane is 180 degrees. And that's true. Euclid tells us that's true, but that's true only in a flat plane. If we live on a curved surface, then in fact, you can draw a triangle that has angles that are much different. And here's a triangle where you go around by the equator, make a 90-degree turn, and go up to the North Pole, make a 90-degree turn, and come back to the equator, and you have, you have a triangle with three right angles, 270 degrees. So if you could measure such a triangle, you know you're on a curved surface, two-dimensional curved surface. So the idea is to do the same thing in space, to look and see if space is curved at three dimensions. And to do that, we use the cosmic microwave background, which is a subject that Martin White will be talking about in much more detail. But I want to give you a brief introduction to one of the most remarkable observations that has been made in recent history. The cosmic microwave background radiation is radiation that's coming at us from the Big Bang. It's really, well, when we look out, in fact, we can predict that if we look out in the universe far enough, we should see a wall. You might think we should see the Big Bang, because remember, if we look out further away, we're looking further back in time. So if we look far enough away, you'd see the Big Bang itself. But you can't, because there's a wall between us and the Big Bang. Not a physical wall, but essentially a wall, just like the wall in this room. I can't see outside this room because the wall is opaque. Okay? If I look out at the universe, as I look back in time, I look at billions of years away, I see galaxies. But eventually, I look at the universe as it was earlier and earlier and earlier, when it was hotter and hotter and hotter. And eventually, I look back at a time when the universe was about 3,000 degrees in temperature. At that time, the radiation was hot enough, so if I took a hydrogen atom, a neutral hydrogen atom, the radiation would break it apart into a proton and an electron. Before that, neutral hydrogen couldn't exist. You had a plasma of gas. And a plasma is opaque to radiation. So if I try to look back further, I can't, because the radiation from back here can't make it out to me. But if I run this film forward at a certain time, as the universe reaches a certain temperature and then cools down below it, hydrogen can combine together to form neutral hydrogen, which is transparent to radiation, which comes all the way to Earth. So if I look out, I should predict that I would see radiation coming at me in all directions from the Big Bang. That prediction was made, although not widely recognized. And that radiation was discovered by accident in New Jersey, of all places, in 1965. Okay? A great discovery, won the Nobel Prize. Now, for our purposes, so that's one of the reasons, by the way, this is why this is so exciting. If we look at that radiation, I'll show you some pictures of it, we get a picture of what the universe looked like when it was about 100,000 years old. Okay? Now, for our purposes, however, there's one particular scale that's very important. We can ask ourselves, how far can a light ray travel in 300,000 years, which is when this was made? Well, 300,000 light years. How big on this image is 300,000 light years? Well, it turns out 300,000 light years is about a degree across on a surface located 15 billion light years away from us that's been expanding away from us. You can work it out. So this is particularly important, because this tells us the distance over which things can communicate with each other causally. So any physics phenomena that happens here can only affect stuff within a region this size. It can't affect anything over here. Now, that means if there's some clump of gas that begins to collapse, pressure can respond to the gas on this scale, but on a clump that's on a bigger scale doesn't even know it's a clump. So we would expect to see characteristic features in that surface that are of order a degree across, because that separates the scale over which causal physics operates from regions that don't know they each other exists. So the idea is to look for such features. Why? Because that gives us a ruler. And a ruler allows us to measure the curvature of the universe. Again, if I put a European student in the back of the room and gave him a ruler and allowed them to measure the angle of the ruler from here and told them the distance to the back of the room, they could work out the angle that you would see. Actually, if I told them the distance and the size of the ruler, plane geometry tell you the angle. But that's in a flat universe. In a curved universe, it turns out as you go backward, back in time, light rays diverge if the universe is open. and they converge if the universe is closed. So the angle that you would see, if I had a ruler of 12 inches, the angle that that ruler would span in my eye would be different if the universe is open or closed or flat. Now we have a ruler, 300,000 light year across ruler. That's the scale of the horizon, the size of which things could communicate at that time. If we can measure those angular features in the cosmic microwave background and ask what angle they span that corresponds to 300,000 light years across, we'll be able to know whether the universe is open, closed, or flat. Because if the angle is smaller, that means the universe is open. If the angle they span is larger, the universe is closed. So the idea is to look for those fluctuations. Well, this is not what we see when we look at the universe. This is the Earth, but this is a projection of a two-dimensional surface on a flat plane. Now I want to take the same projection of that two-dimensional surface located 15 billion light years away from us in all directions and project it as the Cosmic Background Explorer satellite did. And I'm not going to go into this great detail because I'm sure Martin will talk about it more. This is the picture that the COBE satellite first gave us of the universe. Is now where color represents temperature of the early universe, as we see here, as it's, or the temperature of the microwave background as we measure it today, I should say. The first thing you see is that the universe, it sort of looks like a map of Canada. Okay, I say that because I grew up in Canada, and all my textbooks were American. And I noticed when I did geography that there was North America and there'd be all these features until you got to Canada and then it was pink. Anyway, the universe is largely uniform in all directions as far as we could tell, but of course the COBE satellite could do better than that. This is measuring the temperature 1 degree accuracy or so. The COBE satellite could measure temperature to almost one part in a million. So it could measure temperature differences across the sky of a few millionths of a degree. When you expand that picture, you begin to see these lumps here. And those lumps are interesting. But nevertheless, you notice they're much bigger than 1 degree across in the sky. Well, the reason is the COBE satellite only had a resolution of about 10 degrees. So it's not too surprising they could only look at lumps that were larger than 10 degrees or so. To do better, you have to look at something that will allow you to resolve lumps on a smaller scale. And recently, there were a number of experiments. This one is the Boomerang experiment, which I'm pleased to say is headed by someone at Case Western Reserve University now. This experiment launched a balloon near the South Pole, okay? And this balloon went around the world, which is, of course, easy to do if you're near the South Pole, which is why they didn't win $1 million. Right at the South Pole, even I could do it. But on the edge of McMurdo here, this balloon was launched and had on it a microwave radiometer to look at a small patch of the sky, measure that cosmic microwave background radiation, a small patch of the sky, and look for those characteristic features. And this is one of the pictures they produced, which is one of my favorite pictures, because it represents, in my mind, our cosmic myopia. Because, you know, we're used to looking at the sky, and during the day, at least in Santa Barbara, it's light, and at night it's dark. But that's only because we detect visible radiation with our eyes. If our eyes were sensitive to microwave radiation, this is what we would see night or day, as long as we weren't looking at the sun. This is that surface located 15 billion light years away from us. And these are the characteristic lumps we're looking for. And the question is, how big are they on scale? Well, picture's worth a thousand words. Here's the Boomerang picture of these temperature fluctuations. Here's what you'd predict in a closed universe for the characteristic size of the lumps. See, they're bigger. In an open universe, if you look carefully, you'll see the size of the lumps are smaller. And just like Goldilocks, in a flat universe, they're just right. Now, you might not like this qualitative picture. Martin will talk to you in more detail about how we know. But in fact, this measurement tells us that to relatively high accuracy, we appear to live in a flat universe today. A remarkable discovery, made again in 1999, a few years ago, 2000. It's this brand new stuff. But those of you who have been listening realize there's a problem. Because I just proved there wasn't enough matter to make the universe flat. But we now know the universe is flat. Okay. Now, the good thing about being a theorist is it really doesn't matter what they measure. Because us theorists knew for the last 20 years that the universe was flat. Okay, we knew it. So we are very proud of ourselves when this measurement was made. The problem is, of course, that we figured it was flat and therefore there was enough matter to make it flat. And that's where we were wrong. Now, what could make up the rest of the energy of the universe? We have a universe and we have a source of curvature or flatness, and we know that there's not enough matter to make the universe flat. Only 30% of what's necessary. Well, what else could you have there? Well, if you gave empty space energy, it could contribute to that sum. And what would the effect of adding an energy to empty space be? Well, it would give this cosmological constant. What would a cosmological constant do? Well, as I told you, it's a repulsive force, so it would cause the universe, the expansion of the universe, not to slow down, but to in fact speed up with time. So one way to measure if there really is a repulsive force in nature is to look at this distance versus velocity curve, and it turns out if the universe has been accelerating, and this is the kind of thing you have to think of yourself afterwards. I always get confused when I think about this. This curve should turn up if the universe is accelerating, and turn down if the universe is decelerating. If you look at velocities and thus distances that are very far away. So you want to measure the Hubble plot is this part of this, the straight line, measures the Hubble constant today, more or less. But if you ask for the Hubble constant as a function of time, or at least the velocity of the universe as a function of time, then you'll measure, if the universe is accelerating, you'll measure this curve and decelerating that way. Well, everyone knew what the answer was. The universe is decelerating because gravity is universally attractive. And a number of groups around the country designed experiments to measure that quantity. And to measure that quantity, they looked at these type 1a supernovae, which are these objects that I told you about that you could measure at the other end of the universe and use to measure the distance to those galaxies, and we measure the velocity, and we could try and measure the deceleration of the universe. And you see, here are these objects, before and after, you see that the supernovae are as bright as a whole galaxy, sometimes brighter. Here's a supernova that you can see, you couldn't even see the host galaxy it was in. And we used, though, that wonderful fact that these type of supernovae are standard candles, and in 1998, several groups published, where everyone publishes now, the New York Times, and published a result which they found striking, surprising to them, which is that if you look at these curves, and you have to look at them very carefully, so what we've done here is draw a straight line through these curves, and you can ask, are these points up here above or below the straight line? If they're below the straight line, this is what everyone predicted if the universe was decelerating. What they discovered, to their great surprise, is that all of the points seem to lie, on average, above a straight line. Now, I have to say that I would not sell my house based on this data. In spite of the fact that Science Magazine called this the discovery of the year in 1998, or 1999, I forget which year now. I think that was a horrendous thing to do, because when you look at this data, you say it's probably wrong. Or at least, it probably means something else. Maybe what these guys are, look, they're above the curve, means that they're dimmer than they would be otherwise if the universe weren't accelerating, but there are lots of other ways to make the universe look dimmer out there. Maybe there's dust and other stuff. So there's lots of reasons this could be wrong. But in fact, all of the observations we've made over time continue to confirm this. But the amazing thing is, if we say that it's due to an energy of empty space, that the universe is really accelerating, we ask how much energy is in empty space, we find out the amount of energy you need to make this curve fit the data is exactly 70%, more or less, of the energy you need to make the universe flat. Which happens to agree exactly with what we get from the fact that there's only 30% of the energy we need to make the universe flat in matter. So that gives us great confidence that, in fact, what we're measuring here is an energy of empty space. Well, not sort of great confidence, because there's a theorem in cosmology that no theory should agree with all the data, because some of the data is wrong. But in fact, in the years since this discovery was made and all the others, all of the data is coming in and confirming this remarkable fact that we appear to live in a flat universe. 70% of the energy density in that universe is due to nothing, as far as we can tell. 30% is due to something whose origin we don't understand, dark matter. And roughly 1 to 4% is due to everything we see. That's why you get rid of all the stars, all the galaxies, everything you saw in that first picture, and the universe will be largely the same. Our understanding of the universe has completely changed, and it's completely changed in the last decade. And this is truly remarkable, at least to me. So let me close saying, okay, well, this is the situation we now live in. And you're going to hear more about dark matter, and more about the cosmic microwave background, and then more about the operation to repair the Hubble Space Telescope that looked at all this stuff. But here's where we're at. The dominant energy in the universe resides in empty space, apparently. We have no idea why it's there. No one has any idea, and anyone who gives a lecture in this room about it is lying. They think they know. Or wrong. Lying or wrong right now. We have no understanding of that energy density. It's the biggest mystery in all of science, I would say. We do suspect that its existence is probably tied to the very nature of space and time, the origin of the universe. The kind of thing that string theory has so unsuccessfully tried to deal with in the last few years. But the other thing that's important to realize is it will determine our future. In fact, everything has changed. The whole reason I went into cosmology is gone out the window. Because there are new rules. If the dominant energy of the universe is an empty space, the new rules are there are no rules. That beautiful relationship between geometry and destiny that Einstein developed for us is completely wrong. The stuff that's in all the textbooks is completely wrong. Because it turns out, if you endow empty space with energy, a closed universe can expand forever, and an open universe can collapse if you want. Measuring the geometry of the universe, which we finally managed to do after 80 years, doesn't tell us anything about the future. And the whole reason I became a cosmologist is out the window. In fact, myself and a colleague, Michael Turner, have argued that there are no sets of measurements we can make, just observationally, unless we know the nature of the vacuum energy. There are no sets of observations that we can ever make that will tell us the future of the universe. The future is always up for grabs. It'll be an eternal mystery, which is fun. But there is something that isn't an eternal mystery, and this is some work that I've been involved in, which is interesting, it seems to me. And it allows me to use a quote that I've always wanted to use. I heard it in a sociology class when I was in university, from a high school commencement at a private girls' school. And the commencement speaker began his address by saying, "Things are going to get unimaginably worse, and they're never, ever going to get better again." And I've always wanted to use that. And it turns out, for reasons that I won't go into here, that we live in apparently the worst of all possible universes to live in. That if the universe is dominated by the energy of empty space, we know for certain that life will end, that it cannot go on forever, and that the future is as dismal as it can possibly be. So much for intelligent design. But let me not leave you depressed. Let me leave you optimistic, I hope, and a few minutes early, I'm pleased to say. The future is dismal. But we live in this remarkable time when we are learning tremendous things about the universe. Every new window we open up gives us a new surprise. And so it seems to me we should celebrate the fact that we're here, living here at this random time in the middle of no special time or place in the universe, and that we, with our brains, can in fact understand the nature of the universe, at least, and its history from the beginning to close to the end. And so we should enjoy our brief moment in the sun. And in fact, the near future is rosy, because we're going to have a lot of new objects and new devices that are going to tell us things. This is a picture of the next generation space telescope, which is now called the Jack Webb Space Telescope, named after, is that the guy who was on Dragnet? That was a former NASA administrator. Other things, like, for example, this is a large ball of deuterium, or heavy water, located underground in Sudbury, which is looking at neutrinos from the sun. And another huge set of detectors. This is a large interferometer, located in Washington State and Louisiana, looking for gravitational waves in the universe. And here is two objects that will look at a satellite proposed to look at supernovae, 10,000 of them, or 100,000 of them, to try and measure the nature of the dark energy. And here is a beautiful tank of 50,000 gallons, 50,000 tons, I'm sorry, of water, kept absolutely pure in a mine deep underground in Japan, which may tell us about the future of matter in the universe, and which coincidentally begins my most recent book. But anyway, the future is rosy because we have a lot of new windows on the universe, and it's an exciting time. And we're in the middle of it, not the end. We don't know what the answer is, and if you're a theoretical physicist, nothing could be more exciting. Thank you. Now, the schedule has time for questions. Also, it has a coffee break afterwards. My experience has been that when there's a coffee break proposing, the questions are limited. But we do have time for questions now. And of course, there is an open period, of course, during lunch to talk in private. And also, there is a town hall meeting where we'll all be up here to answer questions. But happy to answer some now. So, yes. Are you running to give them a microphone? Is that the way it works? Okay.
I have just a quick question concerning your light meter.
Uh-huh.
What if you had a lot of dust in the room?
Absolutely. This is a good point. If I had a lot of dust, then the light would be absorbed by the dust, and I'd get a different measurement to the distance. So in fact, for those, the fact that, I don't know if I can go back enough. Probably I can. Get rid of the profound stuff to get to the data. Okay. So the fact that these supernovae out here are systematically dimmer than you would think, the first thing you should believe is not that the universe is accelerating, but rather that there's stuff that's making it dimmer. Okay, out there, there's a lot of dust. And that's what you really should first believe. And then you should do tests to see if it can be dust. You can look at absorption in certain ranges of the frequency spectrum which are characteristic of dust. And these people did that, and you can look, and it's not there. Okay? But maybe that's still not good enough. It turns out there's a really good test you can do. And that is, remember I told you the energy of empty space remains constant, whereas the energy density of matter, as you go back in time, increases. So if the energy of empty space dominates now, at early times it was irrelevant. At early times the dominant stuff was matter. Okay? Matter makes the universe decelerate. So what you should see if you go to high enough redshifts, in fact just a little bit past 1, about 1.7, this curve will turn over and the universe will start to decelerate. Now dust won't make that happen because if it's dusty there, it's going to be more and more dusty, and then you expect a monotonic dimming as you go further and further away. What's interesting, and I don't have the slide here, but I do have it somewhere else, is in fact observations of it right now, one supernova at a redshift of 1.7, right here. That suggests that it further suggests that it isn't dust, that you're actually beginning to see the turnaround. But it's a very important systematic uncertainty in this data that we have to be completely convinced of before we can say that this data tells us the universe is accelerating. Now the nice thing is, and the reason I presented this the way I did, unlike the way you normally hear about it in the media, is in my mind this is good evidence that the universe is expanding, but it's not the strongest evidence. To me, the strongest evidence is the many, many different ways we now know that the total mass of the universe is 30% of what we need to make the universe flat, and this beautiful measurement that the universe is flat. That tells us there has to be some energy that's uniformly distributed throughout space that you can't measure on the scale of galaxies and clusters of galaxies. And the fact that this happens to be just at the right level, I find very compelling. If it were just this data alone, I certainly would believe it. And I say that in spite of the fact that I actually predicted it. I used to argue there was a cosmological constant 8 years ago just because it was a reticle. And I didn't believe it either, but I thought it was neat. And then I remember when this was discovered, some journalists asked me, and I said the first time I didn't believe it was when they discovered it. Because you should be skeptical. You should really be skeptical. But all of the data seems to hold together, and the systematic uncertainties are being carefully checked. So we don't think that there's dust. We don't think that's the reason behind this. But it's a very important question. And you have to ask those questions in astronomy and astrophysics. If you make a measurement, that's great, but what are the causes, the possible systematic uncertainties that could get in the way of interpreting that measurement? And that's the difference between an observation and an experiment. Yeah?
How did the results from Sudbury's neutrino shifting thing, how does that affect the description of dark matter?
That's a very good question. What Sudbury and what Kamiokande, what Super Kamiokande in Japan has told us is that neutrinos have mass. A remarkable discovery, which again, I'm surprised it hasn't sort of gotten more attention. Neutrinos, which are apparently the lightest stuff in the universe, have mass. But at the same time, what it tells us is something we kind of already believed already. Neutrinos aren't the dark matter. Because it turns out the mass that neutrinos have, if you measure from the Sudbury experiment and the Kamiokande experiment, are probably 2 to 3 orders of magnitude smaller than that would be, which would be necessary for neutrinos, and there are roughly 100 of them per cubic centimeter everywhere in space. If they had big enough mass, they'd be the dark matter. But that experiment tells us they're not the dark matter, which confirms, in fact, what we already suspected. Because if you build a universe of neutrinos and put it on a computer and ask what it looks like, we knew from the 1980s it doesn't look like the universe we see. In fact, it's coincidental that the total energy in neutrinos, the total energy density in neutrinos, is not that different than the total energy density in normal matter. Both of them are negligible.
Okay. The early part you talked about the red shift.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we look at the hydrogen spectrum,
mm-hmm.
where does the energy go? Because you're measuring photons and lower energy.
Okay, what happens is, there's lots of ways to think about this, but here's my favorite one. I think it's also correct. So as the universe expands, the question was, where does the energy go when those photons redshift? Because remember, Planck and Einstein told us that the energy of a photon is proportional to its frequency. So if the frequency decreases, the energy decreases. And the answer is really quite simple. I want to step back for a second. If you have a universe full of matter and it expands, the density of matter goes as 1 over the volume. Okay? Because it does, right? The number of particles is the same. Okay. Now, I have a universe full of photons. It expands. Why doesn't the density of the photons go down as 1 over the volume? The number of photons is still the same. Okay. It turns out that those photons redshift as the universe expands. Okay. Their frequency gets smaller. Their wavelength is longer. It turns out the energy density of photons goes down as 1 over the fourth power of the size, not 1 over the third power. What happened to that energy? Well, it turns out those photons have pressure. They're moving at the speed of light, and relativity tells us that a gas of photons has a radiation pressure. And you can actually solve Einstein's equations, and you find out that it's elementary thermodynamics. dE equals pdV. Matter doesn't have pressure, because matter's not moving very fast, it turns out. Okay, it's non-relativistic. And so matter doesn't do work against the expansion. But radiation has pressure. And if you solve the equations, you find out the radiation loses its energy by doing work on the expanding universe. So the redshift of photons can be understood, in a sense, as the work done by photons on the expanding universe. So that's where the energy goes. It goes into work in the expanding universe.
Potential energy there?
Well, it's the energy... the point is it goes into gravitational energy of the expanding universe. That's one thing. The other thing I should say is that on very large scales, in general relativity, the notion of energy is meaningless. It has to be changed. And I mean, if photons disturb you, empty space should disturb you a lot more. Because there the universe is expanding, but the energy density remains constant. That means the energy of the universe is increasing tremendously. Density times volume is total energy. The energy of the universe is increasing tremendously. Right? Energy seems to be violated. That's okay. Because it turns out in general relativity, on large scales, you have to redefine what you mean by energy. And on small scales, energy, with the definition we use, is appropriate. But on large scales, we have to accommodate possible curvature of space. We have to change what we mean by the definition of energy. And the naive form of energy is not conserved on the largest scales as the universe expands.
I have a basic question.
Yes.
You were mentioning about the hydrogen atom.
Uh-huh.
You mentioned that quantum mechanics was giving us the wrong answer, and we had to incorporate relativity.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Feynman talk about even though quantum mechanics works, there's something that we don't understand. And the formulation of it.
Yeah.
Has any work done on that direction?
Well, Feynman was, in fact, one of the people who calculated that the effect of relativity on quantum mechanics and got the right answer. That's one of the things he won the Nobel Prize for. But in fact, so while there's a lot we can't intuitively understand about quantum mechanics, as Feynman said, you write down the equation and it gives you the right answers if you add relativity. The problem with quantum mechanics, and we just attended a lecture yesterday about this, is more that we happen to live in what we see as a classical world, right? And therefore, it's very hard for us to understand what happens on the quantum mechanical level where things are crazy. In the world of our experience, I throw a ball, and it goes from here to there, and it takes some trajectory. Okay, you can calculate it in elementary physics. In quantum mechanics, if I do that for an electron, it doesn't take any specific trajectory from here to there. It takes all trajectories at the same time. Now, that's crazy. Now, some people say it's so crazy that there must be something wrong with quantum mechanics. Other people say it's crazy because we have classical intuition. And as my friend and colleague Sidney Coleman puts it, the problem is not the interpretation of quantum mechanics, it's the interpretation of classical mechanics. The world is quantum mechanical, and it works. We happen to live have a classical intuition, and any problems we have is probably due to our intuition more than the nature of quantum mechanics. So I think most people would argue that the only problem with quantum mechanics is intuitively understanding it. But solving the equations gives the right answer. In fact, that's what Feynman used to say, and if you read his book QED, he does a beautiful job of saying just that. I don't know why, but I know how. And how always works. And there's no existing experiments that give any results that disagree with quantum mechanics, the predictions of quantum mechanics. So as a theory and an understanding of nature, it seems to be perfectly appropriate.
Do you know the current research done on those?
Yeah, questions? Sure. There's lots of people who try and test quantum mechanics every day, and it always comes out right. I mean, there's lots of people, those atomic physics type of experiments, which are very sensitively measure the nature of the wave function of electrons around atoms, are doing beautiful, beautiful things, and I'd be happy to talk to you about the break, about testing quantum mechanics. But the results are that it agrees. Yes?
Other than one more assumption in the grand pile of assumptions coming in here,
that's what I wanted you to realize.
It's a large pile. Is there any experimental confirmation that the cosmic ray background is actually from the surface of glass decoupling and not from all the rest of the crap that you can't see?
Well, yeah.
The world is completely unknown to you. Why would you have any reason to believe that this stuff, which you're basing tons of your conclusions on, it seems to me, is actually from anything other than the other stuff you don't understand?
Okay, that's a very good question. I'm going to give you a brief answer. Martin may give a longer answer in his talk, I'm not sure. So I don't want to steal all his thunder. But first of all, I guess the simplest answer is if it walks like a duck and sounds like a duck and quacks like a duck. But hold on, let me just step back, okay? First of all, I make a prediction. Okay? I make a prediction that based on the observed expansion of the universe, okay, which the red shifts, I see, that the universe has a certain age, and I also take the laws of physics as I understand them, and I make a prediction that I should see a background with a temperature 2.7 degrees. When I look out, I see such a background, first. Second, I could say, okay, well, if that's really true, then that really tells me the universe was getting hotter early on, okay? So it was really hot, it was 3,000 degrees back then. Can I independently measure that the early universe was hotter? Yes, I can. Turns out when we measure systems, not at that distance, but a distance between us and that surface, we're measuring systems at a redshift of 3 or 4, which means the universe was hotter by a factor of 3 or 4 than it is now. The universe was 12 degrees, not 3 degrees. I can look at those systems, and if you put an atom in a radiation bath at 12 degrees, if you're very careful, you can actually measure the effect of that. We look at that, what do we see? 12 degrees. Okay? And we also say, well, the same theory that predicts that cosmic microwave background radiation should be there also predicts a few other things. It predicts the abundance of light elements. It predicts the abundance not just of hydrogen, but of helium and lithium. And those, it predicts helium should be 25% of the universe, and lithium should be one part in 10 billion of the universe. We go out and measure the hydrogen, helium, and lithium, we find 25% of the universe roughly is helium, one part in 10 to the 10th of the universe is lithium. So it's the fact that every single observation confirms the same predictions, and they're not all postdictions, they're predictions, and the fact that no other idea can explain what the fact that this background is 3 degrees coincides exactly with what you'd get from the age of the universe, which is 10 to 15 years. So everything holds together, and there's no competing theory that explains those predictions. And every time, and it's not postdictions, as I say, every prediction you make, namely that background is completely thermal, that's very important. It's the best measured black body in nature. No black body ever produced in the laboratory has ever produced a spectrum in as close agreement with quantum mechanics as that background. And no one has a mechanism for a bunch of stars to add up to produce a background that is exactly thermal to one part in 100,000. What we predict the microwave background should be, given the universe is so isotropic. So every prediction agrees observation, but the point is, and this is a really important point, that's probably the biggest thing that I think is misunderstood about science, is that science can never prove something's right. It can only prove something's wrong. And right now, every test we've applied agrees with that idea. You can never know down the road, there won't be some test that tells you this, you have to refine your model. But every single test is in agreement with that. So, I mean, you know, that's the argument I can give, and maybe Martin can give a better one. But.
Okay, so I actually wanted to ask a specific question.
Okay.
The specific question was a question about experiment.
Okay.
Okay, the question about experiment is there something about the structure of that data itself, all right, which tells you implicitly, okay, that it had to come from that source?
Yeah, well, yes, in the sense that we can measure the density of gas in the intervening space. Okay, we measure galaxies. We can do it with the Hubble Space Telescope. How many galaxies there are per cubic centimeter? What the density of gas is around galaxies? We measure the X-ray gas. And this is all well-known physics, so we can calculate the absorption rate of radiation. And we can calculate that the mean free path of a photon is far enough back that, in fact, the photons from microwave background will not be absorbed between there and us. So we should be able to see radiation unimpeded all the way back. So when we see those photons, we know that their mean free path is the same as the size of the universe. We can calculate that independently by measuring the density of matter and using quantum electrodynamics to calculate the scattering cross sections. So those photons are, and in fact, we also measure what's called the redshift. We measure their temperature, and that tells us, in fact, since we measure the redshift of galaxies intervening, that comes from a surface where the redshift was 1,000. And so those are the ways, and a redshift of 1,000, if you work, tells us that the universe was 100,000 years old at that time. So we know that the photons can easily make it there, and the redshift is in agreement with what we get from working backwards in time. Okay. Maybe two more questions, and then. We'll have lots of time for questions, but since you're at the microphone.
Mm-hmm. Let me kind of make two assumptions and tell me if I'm correct with these, and you know, as far as you know, or we all know. The first is, when I look at the Kolbe results, I see a non-constant background temperature of the universe. And when I'm listening to your talk today, I'm assuming that the vacuum energy would be somewhat uniform throughout the universe. Does that seem to be somewhat of a contradiction?
No, in fact, it doesn't. First of all, there are two reasons. You're absolutely right. It's not uniform, but don't get hyped over, and Martin, I'm sure, will emphasize this. Don't get hyped over the fact that it's non-uniform. It's non-uniform at a level that you could never detect if you looked at it directly. The non-uniformities are one part in 100,000. It's more uniform than anything you ever see. Okay, but there are these little lumps, and Martin, I know we'll talk about where they come from and how we get them. Now, you might say, well, look, if the vacuum energy density is uniform, shouldn't it impact upon that? Well, the point is, we have to remember that the vacuum energy density is important now, but if it's really vacuum energy density, it was less and less important. And in fact, if you work back to Z of 1,000, it was so unimportant, it wouldn't have mattered. Okay, so it doesn't affect the physics at that time. In that way.
So it's what happened in the first seconds of the Big Bang?
Well, the first 100,000 years.
Yeah, and then there wasn't very much vacuum energy at that time.
If it's vacuum energy. In fact, it's one of the ways we could put limits on how that energy might vary if it varies.
All right, so therefore, no contradiction.
Yeah.
Great, thank you.
Okay. Last question. Better be a good one. Okay, yes.
You mentioned about 120 pieces of vacuum thickness between the observational data.
No, I haven't reconciled them at all. Namely, in fact, I should have. In fact, thank you very much. I should have pointed that out. The vacuum energy we apparently see now, is 120 orders of magnitude smaller than anyone can explain. Remember, I said thank you so much. I argued at the beginning of the talk, the only sensible value from a theoretical perspective for that number is zero. But observations now tell us it's not zero. And it's 120 orders of magnitude smaller than it should be. That's called the cosmological constant problem. And it is so severe that it's difficult to adequately describe it. our level of lack of understanding is at least 120 decimal places. We understand nothing. Nothing. I mean, it really means there's something fundamentally, profoundly new in nature, probably at its microphysical scales. And that's why it's so exciting. That's why there's a workshop here at the Institute on that subject, and why many physicists, including string theorists, are thinking about this. I think that's a good way to end.